Fiona Ritchie with you for The Thistle and Shamrock. Thanks for joining me. Music of the Funky String Band got us started there with Belle of Benbecula. That was written in honour of Anna Wendy Stevenson, and she'll be playing for us later. On piano for the Funky String Band is Jamie Jauncey. His passion for music is a current that flows through The Witness, his novel on young Picador. Hear how music lends atmosphere, reinforces ties to the land, and sustains the characters in The Witness by James Jauncey, my guest this week. If you approach silence with love, music may result. When we open the book and read that first, it's a tease, I suppose, to the different themes that come together in the book, and perhaps an opportunity for you to tell us what those are.
Yes, absolutely. The opening words in the book are, by the time John McNeill was 18, he had grown used to silence. So that's the silence that the music results from. And as the book progresses, we come to understand more and more that music is an incredibly important part of John's life. He's a fiddle maker. He's young. He's an 18-year-old in this story, but he's learnt how to make fiddles from an old man. And he also plays, and he's passionate about the traditional music of Scotland. And it comes to be very, very significant to him because Scotland at the time of the book, which is set slightly in the future from now, is in great political turmoil. In fact, there's what amounts to a civil war going on in the Highlands. And terrible things are happening. The book opens with an atrocity, which he witnesses. And people are very worried about where this is all leading. They're very unsettled. And the music throughout the book acts as a sort of anchor. It's a sort of bedrock for them. It ties them into their past, into everything that's sort of comforting and familiar and true about being Scottish. So the music has a very, very important part to play in the book, and it's a thread that sort of keeps unravelling really right the way through the story.
Yes, it's more than just an interlude that punctuates the story in interesting ways. It actually serves almost to bookmark some of the key moments in the book, and as you say, as an anchor and a rallying point for the characters in the book. I wonder if you could read us an excerpt that maybe helps to point that up.
In this passage, this is quite well into the book, and John and his young companion, who I expect we'll talk a little bit more about, are on the run from government forces. And they've come down into the town of Aviemore, which is in the central Highlands. And they're going to have an evening meal in a pub where a local ceilidh band is playing. The Dukeri ceilidh band comprised two fiddles, accordion, banjo, bass and drums. Now that the musicians were all lined up, restlessly fingering their instruments, there was an infectious kind of energy about them. They looked suddenly years younger. There was a chorus of whoops and wolf whistles as the older of the two fiddlers stepped forward to the mic. He was short with a high forehead, a fringe of thinning silver hair, and a relaxed, easy energy that let the audience know at once that they were in good hands. His eyes twinkled as he introduced the band as the best ceilidh outfit this side of the grave, then launched into what promised to be a protracted tale involving a virgin and a ripe pair of socks. Already the strained, pinched faces in the audience were giving way to smiles. There were sudden explosions of laughter, not all at appropriate moments. John sensed that these folk had an almost manic determination to be entertained. Maybe Ninian sensed it too. He was becoming fidgety, rattling his spoon against the inside of the ice cream bowl, rocking on his stool. John hushed him and he stopped for a minute, then started again. John noticed that the woman on the neighbouring table was looking their way again, studying Ninian, it seemed, not so much in disapproval as curiosity, something perhaps even bordering on recognition. She looked up and caught John's eye, smiled again, then leaned forward to speak, at which moment the fiddler delivered his punchline to howls of laughter and loud applause, which was still ringing as the band cracked into the first set of reels and the woman returned her attention to the stage. John watched in growing appreciation. The boys could play, no doubt about it. They might be mostly in their 60s, but there was still a crispness there, a bite, with the grace notes and nifty paradiddles, the mouth-watering chord progressions and sudden ripples of syncopation, enough to set John's bum clenching with pleasure. And this was just the warm-up set. Later, when they really got going, some of the tables would be moved away for dancing. Ninian had fallen under their spell too, tapping his foot, nodding his head, intently watching the bows fly across the strings, the fingers dancing up and down the keys. The reels were followed by a set of marches, then more patter from the fiddler, before they glided into an achingly tender rendering of Neil Gow's lament for the death of his second wife. The tune Alec McNab had been playing the first time John and Davy went into his house, as John now knew. A tune penned in sorrow 2.5 centuries ago by one of Scotland's most venerated composers. I lived away from Scotland for quite a long time, and when I came home in the late, early 90s, devolution was starting to be talked about. We were about to get our own measure of government in Scotland, and one of the things that was talked about a lot at that time was how the land in Scotland is owned. And so, for my story, I took this idea sort of to an extreme situation, where they've decided that nobody can own more than an acre, which is the sort of freestanding plot of the garden of a freestanding house. In the fertile parts of Scotland, this is fine because people simply rent the land back from the government and carry on farming. But in the Highlands, where the land is poor and unproductive, nobody really wants to rent it back because you can't make any money out of it. And so the government is really left to look after it itself. And there's a rather Kafkaesque department of land which has been set up to do all this. And of course it's a big, lumbering, inefficient bureaucracy. And it's based in the central belt, to the south, away from the Highlands. And people in the Highlands feel increasingly sort of disenfranchised and neglected and fed up with the situation. And various things happen that propel this into a state of actual conflict. There are riots, the army's called in. And by the time the book opens, there's an armed insurrection going on in the Highlands. John finds Ninian as the only survivor of something terrible that has happened, that he witnesses. Ninian won't speak to him at first. He's aged 8, Ninian. And John worries that he has been sort of traumatised beyond speech. He's seen something so awful that he's lost the power of speech. But actually what happens as the story unfolds is that we come to realise that he has a genetic disorder, a real one, it exists, called Fragile X syndrome, which is rather like autism. It's not autism, but it's similar. There are a number of symptoms, the main one being that great social anxiety. He's very uncomfortable, fearful with people that he doesn't know terribly well. So at first, John has a terrible struggle. He knows that he has to take this boy with him to save him, but the boy is all over the place and has these frightful fits of crying and shrieking and tantrums. But as he gets to know him, they become, in the course of the book, they become close, the two boys. And one of the things that Ninian responds very well to is music. And the music seems to take him away from his own sort of inner turmoil and fragility, and he loses himself in music. So the music becomes as important for Ninian, really, as it does for John in the story.
I think I have an excerpt here I was going to ask you to read that perhaps gives us a little more insight into that.
Yeah. So just to set this little bit up, they've taken refuge in an old, empty lodge up in the hills, a big rambling house that's been empty for years. But there's a lumber room up at the top of the house that's still full of junk. Ninian finds it, and John is looking for him and eventually finds him up there in the top of the house, surrounded by all this junk. Ninian goes off and burrows about amongst the junk and comes out with something to present to John. A black fiddle case. John took it and opened it, heart in mouth. Removed an almost brand new three-quarter-sized fiddle. Strings intact, bow clipped into the lid, rosin cake nestling in its compartment. And wonder of wonders, a carved mouse crawling around the end of the neck where the scroll should have been. Sharp ears, eyes wide, whiskers bristling. Look, he held it out for Ninian to see, the mouse. But Ninian wasn't interested. He pushed the fiddle back to John. Play. John looked at him. Play. How did you know? Ninian smiled again. He must have peeped into the workshop at the cabin when John wasn't looking. Play, play the violin. Here, now. Ninian nodded. Aye, okay then, why not? I'll play. John rosined the bow, then lifted the fiddle to his chin. It was smaller and lighter than he was used to, but as soon as it came to rest on his shoulder, he felt as if something had snapped into place inside him. He flexed his fingers over the neck, gauging the shorter span, made a couple of practice strokes with the bow, then started to play. Ninian watched him for a moment, then started to dance. A few hesitant steps, a twirl here, a hop there, then more and more until he was jigging about as if nothing could ever stop him, and beaming, a smile of innocent childish pleasure that softened his face, put lustre in the brown eyes. In the damp and gloom of the lumber room, John played the mouse fiddle, and Ninian danced. And soon, despite everything, the music worked its magic. John began to feel that long, deep connection with the stream his life had sprung from. And before long, he was smiling too.
So music becomes a comfort for Ninian, this very troubled and very challenged child. But it also becomes a comfort to John and a source of hope. And that's a theme really through the book as well, that music is a kind of an escape. And that was also the case, I think, for you when you were a child, perhaps 8 years old as well.
Yes, funnily enough, it was. I was brought up in the days of the old Scottish country dance bands. I mean, Jimmy Shand and Ian Powery and people like that. Great players, very different from what we hear these days in Scotland. It was a different era, really. It was strictly dance band music. And they'd taken the old wonderful tunes and they were using them as they'd always been written as dance tunes, but with what was then a sort of modern interpretation of them, I suppose. It was the style of music that had been played in Scotland from the early 20th century, I suppose, when the accordion arrived from Italy, I think. And that was the music that I grew up with. And I was sent away to a boarding school when I was just eight. And we had in one of the classrooms, we had one of those old Bakelite radios with a sunburst pattern on the front where the speaker was. And it sat up on a sort of plinth on the wall. And on Tuesdays and Thursday evenings, I think, the BBC, what was then the Scottish Home Service, had a country dance music programme. I used to go and stand as close to it as I possibly could. And I just loved the music at the time. And it's only, I think, really only in much later life that I've come to realise that it was a real lifeline for me, listening to that music, because it linked me with home and it linked me with all the things that were sort of comforting and familiar, and that I was missing because I was away from my family. So it's had a very powerful effect on me. I lived in London for 20 years, and when I came back, aged sort of 40-ish, this was the music that I found myself gravitating back towards, although, of course, it had changed tremendously in that time that I'd been away.
music, interestingly, in the book is also a weapon in struggle in the larger sense, which we'll speak about for a moment, but also on a very personal level. It's a weapon for, or has been a weapon for John against bullying on a very personal level. He early on learned that music could arm him against those who would make him a victim. There's a wonderful line, I'll show you something not a one of them can do, learn you the fiddle, laddie, learn you the fiddle. I mean, it's a lovely thing to think that someone would say, I'll give you a way to stand up to these bullies and restore your self-esteem, not to go out and hit them or meet them on their own terms, but I'll show you how you can do something that they can't do. And it's a lovely moment. And it, that's, you know, in a sense, he's always derived great strength from his knowledge of how to yes. play, and then yes. also from the same old man, how yes. to make yes. the instrument.
There's a bit when I describe how when he starts making his first fiddle, it's like himself he is remaking. You know, he sees this form, because a fiddle is like a body. I mean, it has that sort of human... that human shape to it. It has the waist and the sort of, you know, the contours of a human body, and he has this, his first fiddle is on the bench, you know, with the clamps and the glue and everything in front of him, and he sort of sees it as a metaphor for his own development. You know, he's becoming stronger and from having learnt to do these things. So you're right, he's given a skill by this lovely old man that he meets, which sets him apart from the bullies.
And then of course music is a weapon for the community to protest what's going on in Scotland, in your imagined Scotland of the near future, a way to rally them together, and is seen as very threatening by the authorities. It's seen as subversive.
When John and Ninian go to the Cayley that we read the little bit from, he gets talking to some people who've come down from the north, from Dingwall or somewhere like that, and they've come all this way because they say the authorities already shut down the music in the pubs up there because people are singing revel songs and getting stirred up, and the authorities don't like it. So that's, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. That's been going on for hundreds of years. People have used music to protest.
Yes, folk music in general comes into its own during these times, doesn't it? Because
yes.
people need a way to express their outrage, and very often kind of songs of the people are the songs to speak for them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you played me just before we started a clip from a fantastic Dick Cochran track about the miners' strike here in the UK in the 70s. That's a sort of really classic example of how people get moved to make very, very strong political statements through music.
Come on, you good people, you women and your men. Once more our backs up to the wall, we're being attacked again. Which side are you on? 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 We fought a million battles to defend our hard-won rights, and we're going to have to fight again, and I ask you here tonight, which side are you on? 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 Thatcher sent MacGregor to smash the NUM and break the workers' unity, and I ask you once again, which side are you on? 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 And the Tories rant and tear their hair and shout democracy, but the kind that Tories have in mind is not for you or me. Which side are you on? 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 And they're screaming about ballots, it's pure hypocrisy. If they care so much for ballots, what about the GLC? Which side are you on? 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 By bully boys in uniforms and thugs with riot shields, our comrades' blood is being shed, and still they will not yield. Which side are you on? 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 And it's time for a decision, and you really have to choose. Support the miners' struggle, or the next in line is you. Which side are you on? 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 Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That was Dick Gaughan with Which Side Are You On?, which was written about the miners' strike in the 70s in the UK, but could very well really have been an anthem for the characters who are struggling through The Witness by Jamie Jauncey. And Jamie's here to talk to us about his book. We're talking about the musical thread through the book and enjoying some of the music that has been inspired by the book, or that inspires us when we read the book. We've talked about how music for the characters in the book really is a rallying point. And I mean, even in peaceful times, music brings people together, brings communities together.
When I was growing up in Scotland, the music you heard was very much the music that I've described hearing on the radio, or you went to dances and there was a band who played at dances. What wasn't happening then, or at least wasn't happening where I was brought up, was what I came back to discover, which is that the pub sessions had really taken off. And that's music at its most inclusive, and I love that about it. And it's part of a sort of social glue, isn't it, those sessions. And there's a wonderful feeling that it's not competitive, nobody's there to score points off anyone else. It's just making music for the pure love of it. And for the people who come in to listen, it's being there for the pure love of listening to it. And it's a really lovely thing to be part of.
We're hearing music that inspires writer James Jauncey, author of The Witness, and my guest this week. I'm Fiona Ritchie. As The Thistle and Shamrock continues, stay with me to hear the music Jamie Jauncey makes with the Funky String Band. And we debut new compositions from Pete Clark and Anna Wendy Stevenson, inspired by the book. This is NPR. This is Fiona Ritchie. My guest is writer James Jauncey, and we're travelling across the musical terrain of his novel, The Witness. As the book starts to resolve and as the characters start to reach their conclusion and all the threads come together, they are drawn towards a large settlement of people who are really refugees in their own country, and music erupts among them because they're all gathered together. And it also provides an opportunity for the main character, John, to finally find in himself an opportunity to express a great sadness from within him, which was the loss of his brother, through a spontaneous sort of emerging of a tune. So this is a nice passage because it gives us a sense of that community coming together and playing music together, because, well, there's really not much else hopeful for them left to do at this point, but also on a very personal, very private level for him, because he doesn't really reveal the truth of it to anybody. We hear him finding himself again and finding that hope. I wondered if you might read.
Yes. In this passage, it's very near the end of the book, as you just said, Fiona, and John and Ninian and the girl who they are now travelling with find themselves in this refugee camp, and there's tremendous pressure because they think that the army are about to come in, as very similar to what the sort of Israeli army do in Ramallah and places like that. They're coming in to sort of sweep the place clean of rebel sympathisers. And at the same time, the River Ness is about to burst its banks. So they're trapped between the likelihood of incursion by the army and incursion by the river. And they're trying to ignore it. And this, as you say, the spontaneous session has burst out because people have got instruments. And they're all in a sports hall. Two fiddles, a guitar, a baran, low whistle, concertina. The players were all ages. A fiddler lassie who couldn't have been more than 11 or 12. An old fellow with a polished skull and bushy white sideburns on the low whistle, 70 if he was a day. They were working through some simple jigs, feeling their way with each other, finding the natural groove. And the audience was with them, swaying and tapping their feet where they sat. The only smiling faces John had seen in the whole place. He found a space on the floor. The jigs ended and the musicians nodded and smiled to one another. Pleased with what they'd shared, they fingered their instruments, wondering what to play next. Then the concertina player was off with a fine old reel that brought a smile as John remembered the title. One by one, the others joined in. And as the sound filled out and the tempo settled and the tune started to drive along and the audience and musicians stamped their feet together, John felt the rush of adrenaline he knew so well. The inability to sit still or concentrate any longer. The overwhelming urge to join in, to become part of the music. He peered at the clutter around the musicians, spotted a spare fiddle half out of its case. He got up, apologising to his neighbours, made his way round the wall and bent down by the instrument. The guitarist was first to catch his eye. He smiled and nodded okay. John picked up the fiddle and pulled up a chair. More and more folk were coming in all the time now. The audience must have doubled since John had been here, and the concertina player kept the tunes coming. John was starting to hit his stride when he saw them standing against the back wall. They must only just have arrived. Lila's eyes widened with surprise as she caught sight of him. Then she smiled, and it felt to John as if all the tension in him gave way for a moment. She bent and whispered to Ninian, who looked up and grinned, then immediately looked down again at his feet. When the music came to an end, John laid the fiddle across his knees, but this time he heard the applause only as a distant rush of sound, because now he was aware of something else. The notes he'd been hearing these past days on the fringes of his consciousness were starting to materialise, hanging for a moment like dust motes in his mind, before gradually arranging themselves into something more coherent, the first four bars of a jig, and of their own accord his fingers were feeling them out on the strings. Then the fiddle was back under his chin. The bow started to move in his hand, and he was playing them out loud. Hesitantly at first, then more confidently. He repeated the phrase, extending it to eight bars, played it again, and as he reached the end, the notes for the second eight came tumbling, almost complete, into his head. Now the other musicians started to join in. It was a simple tune, light-hearted and infectious, and by the time they'd played it through twice, everyone had got it. They gave it one more turn before the older fiddler led them into another tune, and another, and another. Finally, he glanced at John and nodded as they returned to the new tune to finish the set, John's heart bursting with the thrill of playing his own composition.
Read to us by the author, an excerpt from The Witness by James Jauncey. And thanks again for being with us to share your book with us, read it, and give us some of these insights into everything that's gone into the book and the musical threads, musical inspirations, and also in that particular excerpt, a sense of that wellspring of creativity, that moment when the creative urge finally breaks loose in someone. And it's a very important moment for the main character in the book, John, because it's a moment of release for him, a moment of healing. And it leads me to want to ask about you. We should remind people that as well as being a writer, you're also a very active musician and a composer. And I wonder about that creative moment in you.
Of the two sort of creative activities in my life, the music is the one that I think less about. The music is the visceral activity and the writing is the sort of more cerebral activity. And it's probably always been like that. And I think that that's why they work well together. It's a good balance. I know on a Monday night when I go down to the Tap Inn for the session that it's, regardless of what else is going on in my life, working life, home life, it's 3 hours when I'm going to utterly lose myself. And I mean, in that sense, it's extremely therapeutic, because I lead a pretty full life and I'm probably not very good at relaxing and unwinding, and that's one thing that really does it for me. I've always used it for that. I remember in sort of when I was probably a teenager, early 20s, at times when I thought life wasn't going as well as I wanted it to, I used to retreat into it. And it's a place where I stop thinking, rather than, it's not a focus of my intellectual activity, it's a very much a focus of my sort of sensual activity, and that's what it does for me. I mean, you have to give it shape if you're going to write things, obviously. It's not just a question of sort of sitting down and playing whatever comes out. And I used to write a lot more than I do now. I went through a period of being a singer-songwriter, and I made a few records and did a bit of broadcasting and that kind of thing. But I found that the songs sort of increasingly turned into actually the written word, and the music became something that I did more and more for relaxation. Oddly enough, that has changed again. The pendulum has sort of swung, and I'm now doing music sort of semi-professionally, I suppose. I'm playing with the Funky String Band, which is the most recent development, really, in my musical career, such as it is. And it's terrific.
We've heard a little bit about the Funky String Band from Luke Plum, who's chatted to us on the programme here, who plays with Shugel Nifty and also plays with you in the Funky String Band. But it's really a band for the 21st century, because its members literally span the globe, but you still manage to come together and play.
Yeah, rehearsing is a little bit difficult, because a quarter of the band live in Australia. That's Peter Daffy, who's a great guitarist, singer, well-known in Australia, a very fine bluegrass player, a singer with a most astounding repertoire of anyone I've ever come across. He knows literally thousands of songs. So Peter's in Australia, which means, you know, we can't really get together once a week for a rehearsal, because Luke and Angus, the third member of the band, who's also in Shugel Nifty, Angus Grant, very fine West Highland fiddler, and me all live in Scotland. So we get together once a year. Peter comes over here and we play venues in Scotland, and then we go out to Australia, which in fact we're about to do.
Is that because the weather's just turned quite cold here, you think?
Absolutely.
It's time to go.
Absolutely. Today it was a freezing day, and in 10 days' time I'm going to be in Victoria and in the beginning of their summer, so I'm looking forward to that very much. It's good time music. It's high energy, it's fun, it puts a smile on people's face, and it's music that we all just love playing.
rain was pouring down. But on the day that I left, you know that rain was pouring down. I'm going home again, baby. I believe I'm gonna leave this town. Going to my hometown, I don't care, believe it if I have to walk. Going to my hometown, I don't care, believe it if I have to walk. Hey, hey, child, I'm gonna move it on over, gonna move it on over from there.
Music by the Funky String Band, one of whose members sits with me here right now, Jamie Jauncey, who as James Jauncey has also written The Witness, and we've been enjoying excerpts from the book and now an excerpt from the Funky String Band, which is one of your other hats. And if you'd like to find that album, and you may find yourself, just go to the Funky String Band website, funkystringband.com. I noticed also in the acknowledgements on The Witness that you mentioned many musicians, and clearly musicians inspire you as well as music, and musicians have given you a lot of support in your writing and in your creative life, and you've mentioned some who are will be very familiar names to people who listen to this programme: Fiddler Pete Clark and Anna Wendy Stevenson also.
Yes.
And they've been moved by your book The Witness to compose music inspired by the characters in the book and by events in the book.
I asked Pete and Anna Wendy, in fact, both to, because they'd both read the book and had both said that they'd enjoyed it. And so I said, well, it would be wonderful if you felt like it, if you felt like writing some pieces. I had several launches in the summer in different places, one in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh Book Festival, which I'm involved in. I thought it would be really nice to have some original music at each of those. And since I'm lucky enough to know quite a lot of very fine musicians, I thought I'd ask more than one, and I also thought it'd be really interesting to see what different people's interpretations were. So the result is that I've ended up with several pieces by Pete Clark. Very much, it has a sort of film score feel, and a lot of people have said that they find this book very visual, so I guess he responded to that in it. It's very much about the landscape of the Highlands, which of course lend themselves perfectly to the kind of adventure story that this is on one level. It's a story of pursuit as John and Ninian flee across the mountains, pursued by government soldiers. And I think that was what spoke very much to Pete. And the other person who also composed something was Anna Wendy Stevenson, who's a lovely fiddle player, who I know you've spoken to on the show before, Fiona. And she's currently teaching a traditional music course up in Benbecula in the Outer Isles. And she's written three pieces. She's written a lament, a strathspey, and a reel. It's a beautiful piece of music.
Music inspired by The Witness by James Jauncey, who's with us just now to talk about the book and the music. And the gift of music has been injected into and around this book by Pete Clark, whose music we've heard, Anna Wendy Stevenson and others. But there's a wonderful way in which the book resolves also with the gift of music.
Yes. Without giving away what happens at the end of the story, he is presented with a very good fiddle by somebody whose gratitude he has earned in the course of the book, and he uses this fiddle at the very end to polish the tune that sort of emerged spontaneously in the session in the refugee camp, which in the end he dedicates to his lost younger brother. And so there's a sort of moment of personal resolution there in that.
Well, thank you very much for sharing with us the book, which you shared first with me as an avid reader, and are now sharing with the wider audience here and giving us some great insights into the textures through the book. It's The Witness by James Jauncey, who, as Jamie Jauncey, also plays in the Funky String Band, and you might want to check out the music as well. Thanks very much for spending some time with us to go through all this, and I know that the listeners have enjoyed it and are probably very curious to find out more.
I've enjoyed it too, Fiona. Thank you.
Witness by James Jauncey is published by Young Picador. Find out more about the music of Jamie Jauncey on piano just there at www.funkystringband.com. You're listening to The Thistle and Shamrock with me, Fiona Ritchie. Our programmes come to you each week from Scotland. Find out more at thistle.npr.org, where programme playlists are posted for you.
But if you want to post a letter to us to get a playlist, just send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Thistle and Shamrock, P.O. Box 518, Matthews, North Carolina 28106. Thanks very much to Jamie Jauncey and to you for joining us. Here's more Funky String Band from their album And You May Find Yourself. Even more music next week, and I hope you'll join me.